It seems so clear-cut that we can claim enough of a consensus to speak out on what is often called the public square. Furthermore, what role does our lack of consensus on theological questions impede our efforts to speak on social questions? These are some of the issues raised by Paul Raiser in his book, Reclaiming Prophetic Witness, Liberal Religion in the Public Square. The book is this year's common read for Unitarian Universalists. Now, the idea of a common read is to have a group of people talk about a book after they have read it, and to see where the discussion takes us. The idea being that all of us, after reading it, have our own perspectives. We glean our own lessons from it, and then we share them. Often it's the case that we learn as much about each other as we do about the book when we have the discussion. This is the reason that many colleges send their incoming freshmen a book that will be a common read. And when the students arrive on campus for their orientation, part of the orientation is discussing the book in small groups. Now, in recent years, the Unitarian Universalist Association has started choosing books for a common read. Since I had already read Reclaiming Prophetic Witness, I was delighted when they chose it for this year's book. Now, I realized that there were some difficulties in getting the book here on time and distributed, for you to read your copy of it before today's service. And so after today's service, I'll hold the first discussion, and it will be general enough that you won't have to have read the book. But hopefully, by next month, everyone will who has ordered a copy will have read the book. And if we have to order more copies, we'll order more copies and have a great discussion. That'll be after the service on November 16th. Now, I first met Paul Raiser, the author of the book, at a minister's gathering probably more than a dozen years ago. Raiser is the epitome of a scholarly minister. In addition to his Master's of Divinity and PhD from Harvard, he has a law degree from the University of Michigan, and he has spent his career teaching at law schools, as well as universities, and even the Quaker Retreat Center. He's currently a professor at Virginia Wesleyan University. In some ways, Raiser reminds me of James Luther Adams, who was probably the preeminent Unitarian Universalist, theologian and ethicist of the 20th century. Raiser's voice, like Adams, is one that connects theological reflection with social action. Raiser's voice is a welcome antidote to those of us who disagree with the mainstream media's willingness to just embrace conservative religions and say that theirs is the religious voice. Raiser argues that we, as religious progressives, also have a voice, and that voice deserves to be heard in the public square. That's one of the reasons why, as a minister, whenever I have an opportunity to write either letters to the editor or a column, I take that opportunity, because I believe that our faith should be out there. The worst comment I hear from newcomers is, gee, we're the best kept secret in town. I don't want our faith to be a secret. I think that our faith has something to contribute, not only to the people who are in this building, but to the wider community. And we can't silence ourselves or squash our voice or squash it. We need to speak out and to have it heard. Otherwise, we're wasting our time. Razor chides the press for their embrace of conservative religions and their willingness to cede the values or religious voice to them. And he also, at the same time, chides religious liberals who sometimes feel as though speaking out would be improper, or it's wrong for us to speak out as religious liberals, as though we're cheapening ourselves or demeaning ourselves by joining the conversation. I think we're cheapening ourselves by our silence. And that's, again, why I'm excited by Razor's book and why I think it's important for us to engage in these issues. Now, this is not a new topic. It's not a new concern. It's not an emerging problem or trend for Unitarian Universalists. It's something that has gone back a long time. James Luther Adams, in the 1940s and 50s, was part of what was called the Federated Faculty at the University of Chicago and Meadville-Lombard Theological School in Chicago, right there on the University of Chicago campus, where First Unitarian Church of Chicago sits. And Adams, at one point, was a member of the board of First Unitarian Church. In 1948, the minister of the congregation was a man by the name of Leslie Pennington. Pennington would become quasi-famous later on because he was the author of John Updike's first father-in-law. And Updike would write stories about how his wife grew up walking around the University of Chicago with a switchblade in her bobby socks. And if you notice, you know, those of you who have read Updike, notice that he tends to take a more orthodox, or at least a view that spends more time on the foibles of humanity rather than its virtues. And Updike would often chide his father-in-law, although not always by name. Adams was a member of the board of the church in 1948, and at the time, Pennington, who was very active in world peace organizations and, you know, integration, came to the board of the church and wanted to make a very conscious effort to integrate the church. You know, as much as we as Unitarian Universalists like to think that we have this wonderful pedigree for being, you know, on the right side, or the quote liberal side, or the progressive side of issues, that's not always the case. And so Pennington felt that he had to go to the board to, you know, get their backing to be active in trying to integrate the church. And most of the board was willing to go along with him, but one board member was very reluctant. And so Adams said to me, "What do you think is the purpose of this church?" The man was silent at first, and then he just started getting agitated and moving around. And he said, "I guess the purpose of the church is to change people like me." And with that, Pennington had the full backing of the board, and the church became a very vital presence in the community. About 5 or 6 years later, they brought in a man by the name of Chris Moore, who had degrees in both theology and music. And Moore started the Children's Youth Choir of Chicago, which is, you know, an enormous group. You know, at this point, you know, thousands of children have participated in that, and they have taken tours all over the country and some overseas, as really ambassadors of our faith. So what Pennington got going by challenging the people to actively integrate the church became a veritable growth movement for the congregation. Now, I use this story for several reasons. As I said first, one was to show that as much as we would like to claim that we're always progressive, that's not always the case. Those of you who were children or adults during the civil rights era will remember that one of the complaints that was often raised about the pace of change was that, aren't we moving a bit too quickly? Can't we wait? This is just a bit uncomfortable. Well, that's part of what being a religious organization is, taking us to our uncomfortable zones, challenging us, and then empowering us to do the right thing, just as Pennington did. And unless your dream is being deferred, you might not realize the anguish of injustice. And so part of what we do is try to help people to see our shortcomings and to see the changes that we personally have to make and we as congregations have to make, and then to move forward with those changes. Look at the past decade. 10 years ago, in the 2004 presidential election, one of the major reasons for George W. Bush's election was that many states were putting referendums on the ballot to make same-sex marriage illegal in their state constitutions. It was an argument from paranoia. It was an argument from fear. 10 years later, look at where we are. We've had a landslide of judicial opinions overthrowing those bigotry amendments, and let's not hesitate to call them that. They're bigotry amendments that were put in there to deny our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters their right to live in a covenanted relationship, their right to live as a legally married couple. As a Unitarian Universalist minister, I remember the 1984 General Assembly in Columbus, Ohio. I was staying with my in-laws, or at least a sister-in-law, and my mother and father-in-law were not that far away. And when the Unitarian Universalist Association decided to support ministers who were performing same-sex services of holy union, I was the butt of their jokes. But I said, this is what we stand for. And this is what I do, and this is where my religious commitments lie. In 1996, the UUA, I would say, finally recognized the right to marry. By that time, in my same-sex services, I was including a line that said, when the state catches up to God and our church and recognizes your marriage, recognizes your, the depth of your commitment and your love for one another, then I will gladly sign your license. As Unitarian Universalists, we have been progressives on issues such as this. And there are other issues that we have to look at in the public square. We can't remain silent. Razor also looks at the connection between religious beliefs and social justice. If you really hold your religious beliefs seriously, then there are times when you are going to have to speak out. And remaining silent is being unfaithful. We can't just look at our beliefs, our values, our principles, as words that we speak as part of a service, as part of an affirmation, but then fail to act on. When we fail to embody them, then we're selling ourselves short. Razor writes, religious liberals on the whole tend to hold religious beliefs with less conviction than their conservative counterparts. And this affects their ability to carry their beliefs into practices. One need only look at the turnout last month of thousands of religious conservatives in Washington, D.C. for what they called the Value Summit. And the press called it the Value Summit. There was no adjective in there. No conservative Value Summit, just the Value Summit. Again, it's as if, as religious liberals, we don't have values, we don't stand for anything. I've read accounts of the Value Summit, the quote Value Summit. And from what I read, it was quite a circus-like atmosphere. You had Sarah Palin in one ring. You had Todd Cruz in another ring. There was some pastor from Arkansas warning that there were 180 to 300 million Muslims waiting to strap on suicide belts and walk into the room and blow them up. Another one said that God was going to take out God's wrath on the United States for tolerating same-sex marriage, all these recent judicial decisions. Now, for one moment, put the fear and the science fiction theology off to the side. Give them their right to gather and to share their stories, to share what they believe is their truth. And then ask yourselves, what do we stand for? What would it take to bring out thousands of religious progressives to gather in one place and to say, this is what we stand for? We disavow this idea of a God of hate and fear. We proclaim a gospel of love and hope and compassion. And these are issues that embody those values. And we are willing to speak about them. We're not going to remain silent. Razor goes on to write, "It is both ironic and tragic that we have come full circle since the civil rights era of the 1950s and 60s, when no one doubted that religion was an important force for progressive social change. Those of you who remember the civil rights era will undoubtedly remember the term soul power. The soul power of the civil rights workers who endured punishment, torture, put their lives on the line. Soul power. Do we have soul power? Can we have soul power? What issues would animate us to stand up and take such similar risks? In 1965, Dr. Martin Luther King called on the clergy of all faiths to join him in Selma. I believe that it was close to a majority of Unitarian Universalist ministers who made the journey to Selma. And when all of the fighting was done in Selma, two Unitarian Universalists were probably the most famous martyrs of that encounter. Reverend James Reed, who was the assistant minister of All Souls Church in Washington, D.C., was beaten by a mob and died. Viola Liuzzo, a Detroit housewife, a member of First Unitarian Church of Detroit, I believe, was shot while driving marchers. Don't religious liberals have values too? Religious liberals do have values. Unfortunately, we spend too much time on intramural debates rather than working together on social issues that can help change our world. Another problem that arises is we can become too fond of our purity tests. Should we be speaking out? We might offend people. Speaking out from a religious perspective is something that the conservatives do. All those fundies. We don't do such things. It's beneath us. Dare we offend anyone? Maybe we need to learn how to offend. Sometimes we're worried that we'll have to work along with people who don't have exactly the same beliefs as we do theologically. We might have to do Jesus, or let them do Jesus. Let them do Jesus if it brings us together. Paul Razor writes that we often conflate the terms religious liberals and the religious left. And by doing so, we don't realize how much the two groups have in common and how well they can work together when each acts from its own beliefs. The religious liberals, when we talk about this, that's Unitarian Universalists, Reformed Jews, many United Methodists or United Church of Christ congregations, even there are certainly a lot of Buddhist groups who fit into this category. We're liberal in the way we do religion. But the religious left has people like Jim Wallace of the Sojourners community, or the ticket, Rabbi Michael Lerner, and his group of religious progressives. Now, I doubt whether many of us would enjoy sitting through all their sermons, but when it comes to working together on social issues, there are a lot of ways in which we can. We just have to put the purity test to the side. Let them do Jesus or do God, whatever they want to do that helps them to get to the same position that we're at. Now, in addition to holding our beliefs with less commitment and less passion, Razor says that religious liberals are often too accommodating, too reluctant to embrace change. And the paradigmatic example of this would be, you know, the board member of First Unitarian Church of Chicago, who was worried that, you know, if we're in church, we're going to have black people along with us. And, you know, that's not the way that we're used to having our church. You know, I'm reminded of when I served a church in central Pennsylvania. And one of the ways that I liked, you know, to end the services was having a song, you know, that would be really easy, like Shalom Havirim, in the original version, in the shortened version, where Shalom Havirim, Shalom Havirim, Shalom Shalom, Shalom Havirim, Shalom Havirim, Shalom. You can memorize that after a couple of weeks, and people can hold their hands. You know, there's a feeling of solidarity. But a member of the congregation came to me, you know, shortly after and said, you know, a lot of us come from German heritages and we know that we wash our hands, but we're not sure if the people next to us have washed their hands before us. So I said, well, you know, maybe it's the church is, that we're the washed and the unwashed together. And there's something wonderful about him being here. And don't be scared. Nobody's ever died of an infection in my congregations. Religion does involve taking us out of our comfort zones. But once we surmount those zones, we see the beauty of being together. Now, as I move toward the conclusion of the sermon, I want to share a quote from Paul Razor on why he wrote the book. He writes, "A central goal of this book is to help make liberal prophetic practice more effective by encouraging religious liberals to engage social justice issues more intentionally as religious actors. To do so, we need to get past our prejudice that speaking religiously in public is something that proper religious liberals just don't do. What we do here and what we say has meaning. We have a message that can transform people's lives. It is one that can raise the spirits of those who are living under conditions of oppression, as well as those who are acting oppressively without even knowing it." Ethicist Robin Lovin, a Methodist who was a University of Chicago professor when I was there, and one of my dissertation readers, tells us, "More fully developed religious ideas do not simply replicate cultural notions of personal satisfaction. They enrich our sense of the possibilities life offers, extend our concerns to people and places we have heretofore ignored, and transform our sense of what would make us happy by showing us ways of life that our very limited experience could not devise. Let us have the courage to embrace the prophetic, to stand on the side of love, and to embrace the cause of justice. To paraphrase the words of John Murray, who was sometimes called the father of American universalism, let us take our faith out to the highways and byways, bearing witness to its transforming power in the streets and town squares and throughout the media, to reach other members of our community. Let us be recognized by the depth of our love and compassion as we embody our values and do our utmost to make a difference in this world. We have a message that can transform, not only ourselves as individuals, but our congregation and our wider society. Let us not be silent. Let us speak out. This is holy and righteous work. It is our work, all of our work, to accomplish together. So be it.